Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
It's our custom to introduce ourselves, those of us who are physically in the room. So my name is Henry.
Alex.
Luis.
Christian.
I'm Greg.
Diego.
I'm Lee.
Marcus.
My name is Jerry.
Stephen.
Dalton.
I'm Brad.
My name is Cass.
I'm George.
Bob.
George.
Jack.
I'm Richard.
I'm Tony.
Jay.
And it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker today. Our speaker is John Martin, who is physically in the room.
Still.
John Martin teaches Vipassana, which is insight, Metta, which is loving kindness, and LGBTQIA plus meditation retreats. John leads an ongoing weekly Monday evening meditation group in San Francisco. He also serves as co-chair of the Guiding Teachers Council for Spirit Rock. His practice has been supported by 12 years as a hospice volunteer, including 5 years at Shanti Project during the AIDS crisis, and 7 years with the Zen Hospice Project. And I'd like to add that John will be leading an LGBTQ retreat at Spirit Rock this October.
Okay, thank you. I might also mention that this coming Saturday, the Insight Teachers of San Francisco are coming together. We're forming one organization called San Francisco Insight Dharma Center. And we're going to have a launch event at St. John's Church in the Mission from 10 to 1. So you could probably find it Insight Dharma Center online, San Francisco Insight Dharma Center, if you're interested in checking that out. So a big thing, Eugene, Howie, Anushka, Victoria, Carrie, myself, we've always had our own weekly sanghas, never came together as one organization. So finally we're creating one organization. So I loved hearing one of their practitioners online mention that the first time here in 10 years. And the Buddha said, once you're on the path, there's no getting off the path. You can try it. You'll still come back to it. And the Buddha also said that the practice is for everyone. Everyone belongs in the Dharma without exception. Every being has a potentiality for awakening. The Buddha called it Gandhava, the seed of awakening within that every single being has. So every being belongs in the Dharma. The Dharma, of course, being the truth of the way things are. So our practice, for all of us, leads in the direction of peace. And we realize peace along the path of practice, sometimes even many times people who are not in the practice realize moments, times of great peace. And ultimately the practice leads toward an unshakable peace, a peace that's not dependent on any condition of our lives, any condition of the world, not dependent on our own health, our relationships, or the politics of our country, a peace that can't be disturbed by anything. So I want to emphasize today that there are these moments when we open to peace and they should be appreciated, valued, because they support the future arising of clarity and wisdom. And it's important, too, to recognize that our practice leads in the direction of the greatest peace, kind of knowing the direction of the path of our practice. And this is a quote on that from a famous yogi. If you don't know where you're going, you might not get there. Some of you may recognize that as Yogi Berra. It is actually important to know where we're going in the path of practice to a peace and happiness that's not dependent on the conditions of the world. So in today's talk, I'll both review what peace means, how we can understand peace, and I want to share some vignettes from my own life in San Francisco. I've been here 42 years. Yesterday, I remembered, was my 42nd anniversary of moving to San Francisco. I moved here when I didn't know a single person. I think I was ready to come out subconsciously, or not consciously. But share a few stories over those 42 years of how peace was coming forward very naturally in my practice. And even before I had a practice, peace was coming forward. And then as I entered the practice and started to understand the nature of suffering, the cause of suffering, recognizing that the clinging, the wanting things to be different, is a cause of mental suffering that we can all be entirely free of, then my practice started to open to a much greater peace. So practice, our practice is about cultivating an inner peace, a peace that's not dependent on the external conditions of our lives or the world. One of the definitions from Merriam-Webster of peace that I connect with in the Buddhist understanding is that peace means freedom from disquieting our oppressive thoughts or emotions. So you can reflect for a moment on when you experience peace. It might be when you're in nature. You're probably not thinking about the past or thinking about the future. You're just present in nature. Maybe it's seeing a sunset, just there, watching the sunset. Nothing else to do, nothing to be different. Maybe it's just walking down Valencia Street amongst people who are happy and joyful, amongst the homeless who are suffering, just being present right in the middle of it. Maybe being connected to the body, to the breath, as the anchor for being present. And perhaps recognizing this moment is just as it is. It can't be any different. It can't be any different. No moment can be different than it is. It doesn't mean that we don't take action to address an injustice or to correct a problem, but the very present moment can't be different than it is. And when we recognize that, we truly begin to make peace with the world and begin to make peace in our own hearts. Peace can be understood as tranquility or calm. And maybe if you recall the time when you experienced a great sense of peace, you felt the calm and the tranquility that can come forward. There's a sense of being in harmony with things as they are. Maybe being in harmony with nature. Hearing music, hearing the harmony of music, we feel a sense of harmony. Hasalainas the Dalai Lama says, world peace must develop from inner peace. Peace is not just mere absence of violence. Peace is, I think, the manifestation of human compassion. We have to open to our inner peace to make peace with the world, in fact. And we make peace by being present, as I said, in the body, by cultivating an attitude of kindness, an attitude of compassion, an attitude of accepting the present moment, just as it is. And with the Buddhist practice, we're called upon to support a deeper understanding of peace by being present to recognize and know that there is suffering. There is suffering in the world, there is our own suffering. There's old age, sickness, and death. There's a recognition that everything we know and love in the world will pass away. There is a suffering, it's unavoidable. We get what we don't like, We don't get what we want. We're not the stage director of actually our own life. And we begin to see, we're called upon to see the cause of the mental suffering is our resistance to things as they are. And when we let go of resistance, then we open to the greatest peace. That's kind of turning against the stream, the Buddha said, because most beings are looking for freedom, peace, and happiness in the material world. And it's not to be found. It's all unstable. And if we try and find it in the material world, we are going to suffer. There's no way around it. And when we let go, we open to this greater peace. There's this phrase from the third Zen patriarch. This is the phrase that I use very much in my daily life practice. The great way is not difficult for those not attached to preferences. The great way is not difficult for those not attached to preferences. This is a translation from Richard Clark, his most recent translation of Verses of the Faith Mind. I like it because it says, not attached to preferences. I'm engaged in the world. I have preferences. I prefer to be healthy. I prefer people in my life to behave reasonably and not act out. I prefer the politics of our country to be different. And yet, I know the practice is to let go of attaching my happiness to things being the way that I prefer them to be. So I watch, I pay attention, I'm mindful. Where do I begin to attach my happiness to things needing to be a particular way? There's actually a great sense of mystery and openness when we begin to let go of attaching to our preferences. When I'm on a retreat, I have the intention of letting go of all preferences. I'm allergic to a lot of foods, and sometimes on retreats, I'll have 3 days in a row. I don't eat dinner, I just eat oatmeal for breakfast and a really nice lunch. And sometimes 3 days in a row, I think even one day, 4 days, I could not eat the main meal. I ate rice, plain beans, and plain tofu. And so I was watching the mind, like, is there any attachment? And usually there was, but sometimes, like, sinking in after 5-6 weeks on a 3-month-long retreat, no problem. No attachment, no attachments whatsoever. That quote actually showed up. I looked at your website last night, and I think it's an older version of Richard Clark's interpretation of this Verses of the Faith Mind, and that is the way I practice on retreats. The great way is not difficult for those without preferences. And in my own life, I don't think I can be without preferences unless I become a monastic and live in a monastery. We begin in being present in the body and being present with the breath, the anchor of being present, paying attention to see where the mind gets hooked on attaching to our preferences. We begin to see more clearly what leads to peace, what leads to suffering. And we begin to open our hearts to every part of our experience. This is a quote from Ram Dass, one of my favorite quotes from the last few years I've been using. Ram Dass was a gay mystic. I didn't know he was gay until after he died, about a minute he did. Being peacefully in relationship to everything made me realize that my happiness isn't based on the situation being this way or that way. My happiness is one which embraces my sadness, and my love is one which embraces my own hate. A lot of great wisdom in that. Not hating even the hate when it arises, but meeting every part of the experience with love and acceptance. And that attitude is going to be what supports the opening to the greatest peace as possible. Now, we all experience this pull toward peace. There's moments of peace. I just learned a new Pali word. Pali was the language of the Buddha. I was listening to a Buddha Dasa talk this weekend. And Buddha Dasa, I use the word Nibbuti. Nibbuti sounds a little bit like Nibbana, doesn't it? Nibbuti means a peaceful and relaxed mind, free of defilements. Buddhi. So we experience moments of Nibbuddhi, maybe in nature, listening to music, just walking down the streets, moments of peace. So maybe you can say to a friend when you experience those moments, get together with a friend the next day, I had a moment of Nibbuddhi yesterday. Pretty close to Nibbana. It's like a friend of Nibbana. So I think I was drawn when I moved here in 1981. I got a little apartment, a studio on 8th and Market. It was a building that's been torn down, but it would be right above where that vacant Whole Foods is now at 8th and Market. So I moved in June 10th, and a few weeks after I moved in, there was a pride parade. And I wasn't out, wasn't quite sure what was coming, but I was ready, I guess. And wow, step out in that crowd and the parade and all that joy and happiness. And there was no shame and there was no fear and there was no self-judgment. People were celebrating. There was some powerful peace there. There was some Nibbuddhi. And it inspired me. I think it inspired me to come out, be true to who I was. And for all of us, we had at some level that coming out process we had to do to move beyond the defilements of self-judgment, aversion, societal pressures, to be true to who we are. It's a quote from Krishnamurti. As long as you're trying to be something other than what you actually are, your mind wears itself out. But if you say, this is what I am, it is a fact that I'm going to investigate and understand, then you go beyond. The understanding I like to teach from this kind of quote is that we have to come into the practice, we have to fully acknowledge who we are. For the vast majority of us, we've done that and being true to who we are. Sometimes it can seem like an ongoing process, so it certainly has been for me. And then in being true to who we are, coming into the fullness of who we are, then we can investigate. We can investigate our own direct experience to see when the mind attaches to the preferences and when we let go of preferences and see the freedom and peace that can arise. So the next period of my life here was that I'll touch on was in the 90s, in the AIDS crisis, when it hit me the strongest was in the early 90s. I know it hit many of you earlier, but that's when I lost the most friends, was in the early 90s. A lot of friends who were sick and died pretty quickly. And I was with so many friends at their bedside. And you know, it sometimes happens when we come close to death. You know it can't be different. It is like this. And I was suddenly had a lot of equanimity and for peace coming forward, even with that. It wouldn't be my preference for any of that. But there was a peacefulness that recognized it couldn't be different. And I didn't have a Buddhist practice then. I wasn't a meditator. But there's a sense of peace, and I was coming close, obviously, looking back to suffering, to sickness and death, to impermanence. Buddha said we have to open to understanding, dukkha, understanding suffering, in order to be free of suffering. So there may have been some wisdom arising, even though I didn't recognize it at the time. And I did feel somehow closer to the truth, even though I had no idea what the truth meant. I guess that became kind of a pull toward meditation practice. And there was a sense of aliveness I actually felt in that time too. I felt more fully alive, maybe in coming close to death, maybe in acknowledging this is the way it is, maybe not being and seeing the preciousness of this human life and never knowing when death can hit me or any of us. We acknowledge that, if we come close to it, there can be a greater sense of aliveness that comes forward. I bring teachings on death a lot into my offerings at Spirit Rock, and next year, 2024, I'm going to be teaching a week-long retreat just on death contemplations. And most of all, when I teach, death contemplations, teach impermanence. Most practitioners who stick with it for a period of time report what comes forward as happiness and ease. So we're so habitually conditioned to turn away from it. There's kind of a relief in turning toward it directly. So we can find peace. I opened to peace of equanimity, even in the midst of that suffering in a very unexpected way. I still felt grief and sadness. Wouldn't have wanted to be that way, but there was a sense of peace in the midst of it. And this is what the Buddha said, that if we open and acknowledge that there is suffering, if we recognize the suffering, we're not alone in the suffering we experience. And if we recognize the resistance in the mind, this mental suffering that we don't need is really optional, then we can open to a much greater kind of peace, to Nibbuddhi. So, turn toward the year around 2000, looking back over my 42 years in San Francisco. I had been with my partner, now my husband, 30 years we've been together. And I had a good job, a job I liked, had a partner, a lot of great things living in San Francisco. I still think San Francisco is a great place to live, despite what the Chronicle says. And so all these good things, and I felt like it's not enough. There's a sense of unsatisfactoriness, that there has to be something more. And the Buddha said, part of dukkha, suffering, is that everything we know and love will pass away. Maybe I was connecting, maybe a little bit subconsciously, and recognizing my career, my partner, my life, everything would pass away, the good health I had at the time. So it started to be a pull toward practice, and then the tipping point was I started having a whole lot of physical pain in the body that I really hated. I was at war with it, and I felt I had to get rid of this pain to be happy. Just felt like I couldn't go on if I couldn't get rid of it. So I went to Spirit Rock, and I had a lot of suffering. It said suffering brings people to practice. I had a lot of suffering. And it was kind of a radical instruction at the time. One of my teachers, Philip Moffat, and now a good friend. And Philip said to me on one of his first retreats, bring kindness and compassion to the physical pain you're experiencing and go into it, be present with it. And name the sensation silently, see what emotions are present. And I started to change the attitude toward the sensation, started to change. There was also a kind of an opening to a trauma that was held in the body that needed to be released. But I saw the changing nature, like first it was tight and painful, and then it was throbbing, and then it was pulsing, then there was anger, then there was fear, it was unpleasant. Oh, now it actually feels neutral. It's just tension, it feels neutral. Now it's kind of going moment to moment. The experience was changing moment to moment. And I started actually seeing that the, and knowing directly, this is a call of practice to know directly, that the resistance to the pain was, in my case, 100% of the problem. That it was just sensation. It was just sensation. Everything else was an add-on in the mind, thinking it needed to be different. The sensations still come up in the body. Once in a while, they're unpleasant. No problem. Unpleasant can arise and pass away. It's non-attachment. So I started making peace with my own body, started making peace with the way things are. So to acknowledge too, sometimes we have great physical pain, and it's not strictly in the mind, but almost always the mind, if we're not paying attention, will tend to greatly magnify the experience of pain. I'd like to reiterate the Four Noble Truths again. The Four Noble Truths, kind of the essence of the Buddha's teachings. I remember one time I was at a hospice shift, and people often have hospice care, family members, because they really open up to the truth. And a woman had just died, and her nephew was with her, and he said to me, after she died, we're sitting in the living room at the Zen hospice guest house, and he said, "Tell me the essence of the Buddha's teachings." Just out of the blue. And there are so many stories of the Buddha, of people asking the Buddha questions like that. The Buddha would know exactly what to say. So I offered the Four Noble Truths. But unlike the Buddhist, the way the Buddha offered it, I don't think that being was fully awake and not hearing these truths. The Four Noble Truths, that there is suffering. There is suffering. And we know it. We feel suffering in our lives. Old age, sickness, and death. Everything we know and love will pass away. We don't always get what we want. And we definitely get things we don't want. That's suffering. And when I first heard this at Spirit Rock on a retreat, it was kind of shook my world. It's not just me, because I came in thinking something's wrong with me to be feeling suffering, to have so much suffering. So it's the suffering of the world. And when I get caught in suffering, I still like to remind myself, so many people in the world, probably millions of people, having right this moment the same kind of suffering that I experienced. Maybe a mental reactivity, maybe a physical pain, maybe experiencing grief. It's part of the human condition. There is suffering. And there is a cause of suffering, a cause of the mental suffering, which is craving, wanting it to be different, wanting to attach our happiness to our preferences is a great way to say it. The cause of the mental suffering is craving, craving for what is pleasant and pleasurable, craving to get rid of what is unpleasant and painful. That is the cause of the mental suffering that we can be entirely free of. And when we experience nibbuddhi, those moments when we're at peace, there's no craving. So that's what I'm asking you to bring attention to, those moments when you feel some peace, some ease. They happen all the time. It doesn't necessarily that you have a deep practice in that moment. You're just maybe enthralled in listening to music or just fully present in the body. Your heart is open. You're aware walking down the street. Not necessarily a really kind of special moment. It can happen at any moment. Appreciate it, recognizing there's no craving. There's no wanting it to be different. It's going to help kind of like strengthen those grooves in your heart and mind to understand what leads toward peace. So the third noble truth is that there is an end in suffering. Peace is possible. Peace is possible any moment, that moment of nibbuddhi. Peace is possible in any moment. And it's so immediate. These three noble truths, four noble truths. Fourth noble truth is there is a path of practice. They can seem so far away. The Buddha said we're to know and understand the four noble truths directly, viscerally. Not through the head, but kind of viscerally understand. So in any moment, when I get caught in feeling, say, anger about a situation, I'm present, feel the anger in the body, I'm suffering. Meet the moment with compassion. I'm suffering. With anger, a lot of times I'm feeling it, it just goes away. Naming it feels away. It loses its power. Sometimes kind of have to hold the anger like it's a crying baby and give it attention. Feel the anger in the body, and then it drops away. And when it drops away, there's peace. It's that immediate. There's suffering, there's anger. There's a cause, which is aversion of wanting the anger to go away or to deny it. There's a clear seeing of it, and there's a moment of peace. The understanding of the Four Noble Truths, the deepest understanding, occurs in a single moment that frees the heart and mind entirely, the deepest level of understanding. We practice for years and years. I practice for years and years. I'm still going on long retreats. But I know directly, viscerally, the practice, all of that practice is for these moments of clarity that arrive, the moments of insight to clearly see and know things as they are. we can so much make kind of a specific condition of our lives, like something we have to get rid of. For years, my neighbor had a barking dog. Every time the neighbor was gone, the dog was barking. Every moment, that poor dog must have had a lot of anxiety. And I would meditate, like, I need that dog to stop barking, to meditate. I can't have a peaceful meditation if the dog is barking. Ugh. And it became my teacher. Like, that dog became my teacher. Because that was a reminder, if the mind is caught and clean and wanting it to be different. The dog was not causing a problem, the mind was causing a problem. And then I could bring attention to what the mind was doing. So the mind is a great teacher. So now I have a dog that barks, my neighbor no longer has a dog. I remember a retreat a few years ago at a 3-month retreat at IMS, Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts. And they must have set this up. It was all like they timed it. The retreat started, they started cutting the trees, it went on for a week, right outside of the meditation hall, all cutting of all the trees, cutting down the trees. And then the roofers came. They finished the trees, and the roofers came right above my room. They're moving the slate tiles, putting on new slate tiles. Done. The road crew came. 80 feet from the meditation hall. They removed, jackhammered all of the pavement, all in a way. And the road crews came to lay down new pavement. Finally, peace. Then it got cold. They have banging radiators. Steam radiator. Listening to the radiators became my practice. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what's present. You can have a moment of awakening in any condition. Our happiness is not dependent on anything. So just to summarize, I like to leave time for questions and comments. That's why I keep looking at my watch. Appreciate those moments of peace that can happen anytime. They're probably being supported by your practice of being present, aware, connected to the body, by your good intentions to bring kindness, compassion, goodness to the world. All of those things support peace. Seeing, recognizing what leads to suffering, clinging, the holding on lead inevitably to mental suffering, and we can be free of it. Knowing that preferences are natural, if we're engaged in the world, we do have preferences, but we can let go. We can very consciously let go of attaching our happiness to our preferences. The great possibility we can be at peace at any moment, even at the very end of our lives, is just like this now. Peace is possible. So we practice to realize what's already here. You could say peace, nibbana, are already here. And I've decided to, as a teacher, start talking about nibbana more, because I've heard so many people think that nibbana, ultimate freedom, is not possible in this lifetime. The Buddha said every being can realize freedom, every single being. It's so disheartening to hear people think that it's not possible. Peace is already here. Nirvana is here. All that's preventing us from seeing and knowing it is the force of greed and aversion, wanting and not wanting the material conditions of our lives and of the world to be different. Peace is already here. I love this quote from Mingyur Rinpoche. The insight that the Buddha discovered is so simple and yet so difficult to accept. His teachings introduce us to a dormant, hidden, unrealized part of ourselves. This is a great paradox of the Buddhist path, that we practice in order to know what we already are. Therefore, attaining nothing, getting nothing, going nowhere, we seek to uncover what has always been. So it's a little bit of a conundrum. Here I started the talk by saying this is the direction of our practice toward ultimate peace. The goal of practice, the direction of practice, and yet when it's realized, we realize, oh, it's here. It's always been here. nothing's missing in my own heart and mind. Nothing's missing in this present moment. Peace is simply in being here right now. So I'll close with a quote from a Beatles song from John Lennon. You probably all know the words. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for, and no religion too. Imagine all the people living in peace. You may say that I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us, and the world will be as one. So much violence and hatred in the world. So much confusion, and what leads to peace? Not the violence leads to peace. I'll open it up to any questions or comments or thoughts. And Henry, I'll rely upon you for how to call on folks online. So.
Okay. What is there a retreat in October going to be like?
It will be alternating periods of sitting and walking in silence. It's about 95 people. Last, I taught an LGBT retreat a year and a half ago, and it was great. There, like 30% of the people were under 30, so a lot of young people coming in. And I think 15 folks were transgender and non-binary, and I think it was about 35% Black, Indigenous people of color. So we've really, Spirit Rock has come a long way from where we were 20 years ago, where there was such a different kind of demographic. So. It's sitting and walking in silence and offering metta instruction every afternoon, a talk every evening. And there's such a beautiful feeling. Have you been on an LGBT retreat before?
Not on an LGBT.
There's such a feeling of safety of being in community. And I didn't really expect it until I finally attended one. Yeah. Anybody else been on an LGBT retreat, multi-day retreat?
How long is it going to be?
I think it's 5 nights, 6 days.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Yes?
My thoughts, thank you for your time.
Sure.
My thoughts are that I don't always have to sit and listen to jackhammers. Mm-hmm. I can leave that space and go find some relief in a forest of trees.
Yeah.
So I realized that there are some things when you're walking down Valencia Street that you're going to see people sleeping in doorways.
Yeah.
On my way here this morning, someone was screaming at me and I had to accept that.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were having a bad morning. But I also believe in the ability and the right and the taking care of yourself enough to move away from things that are harmful, mm-hmm. abusive, or destructive.
Absolutely. I agree completely. And that's why I go
accepting the things I can change and the courage to change the things I can.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the wisdom to know the difference.
I was on retreat for the month of March at the Forest Refuge, and it's in a perfect condition in the conditions in the woods. They hold, the staff keeps the silence so well. The floors are cork. I mean, they do everything to keep it really quiet. And the Buddha said, like, go to meditate, go to retreat in the forest and sit at the foot of a tree. So the Buddha, what you just said is consistent with the Buddha's instruction. This Buddha Dasa talk I heard, I swear there were chickens. But he was giving the talk in a chicken coop.
And there are some sounds. I did an LGBTQ retreat at Spirit Rock a number of years ago. And it was in the spring. And I think it was Larry Yang and Arena.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Silent.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a hard time sitting with silence. It's the first time I've done a silent retreat for several days. But the sound of the frogs mm-hmm. in the stream there that were in mating mode.
Mm-hmm.
And the turkeys that were out there doing their mating dances were a pleasant experience,
mm-hmm.
a background experience while I was there, and helped me calm down.
Yeah,
so
beautiful. And I bet if you ask people in the room how many people found it disturbing, there'd probably be some people who were in that hall who didn't like the science of the Antarctic. There's a couple of years of my life where I lived in Berlin. It's really near the ocean. And I thought friends up come up and stay with me. And one time a friend came up and said, "How do you sleep? The sound of the ocean is so loud."
I just want to say that when you said the present moment cannot be any different than it is, that was sort of earth-shattering for me. So thank you.
It really can't be, and we don't want it to be. Like we don't. That's where we prefer it to be different, but it is like this now. And I think some of the world's greatest leaders like came to that place. I think Nelson Mandela was living like a monastic in jail for a lot of times. All the hatred, and yet when the apartheid government finally said, we're leaving, you're going to become a leader, we're afraid you're going to engage in retribution, that because he was so grounded in reality, that the hatred that was present in South Africa, that he could say, there's been enough hatred toward other beings, we're not going to do that. There's no retribution. And the leaders can have such powerful voices when they accept even terrible conditions as they are. Thank you for sharing that. Awakening can come in any moment. In any moment, insights just... And like, the way you said that, I feel you know it. You know, it's not from a thinking mind. You felt it. And this is what the practice is about. You know, it's not intellectual. It's not figuring out. There's a value to reading books, and there is some value to thinking. But wisdom actually comes from a direct visceral experience. What you express felt like wisdom, because it is from that direct experience.
Another memory from another retreat. One time I was at a deer park monastery in Escondido with Thich Nhat Hanh and the monks and nuns there, and I had been there once before that as well, and it was always a wonderful experience being around that energy. But one night, while we were trying to sleep, there were a pack of coyotes in the canyon there howling, and my first reaction, of course, was, oh, are they going to come down here and eat us all? And I had to just sit with that and focus on my breath and go to my practice and calm down and say, well, that's the way it's going to be. And on the way to and from the tent that I was sleeping in, there were many snakes because it's dry. It was September. It was a dry area and lots of snakes. And you just had to accept the fact that you and the snakes were going to be there together and go with what was happening. And when I got that to that point, there was a lot of peace, for sure.
Beautiful. I do remember being on one retreat, though, and it was a self-retreat, an old cottage I had. It was near a chicken farm, which attracts rats. And it was maybe third or fourth day, and I heard 15, I counted 15 rats in the cottage, mostly the walls of the cottage that I was in. And then a couple came into the living space, and I got up and left. That was too much.
John, you mentioned that you do all the practice, or we do all the practice in retreat to experience those moments of presence, I guess. And I think you said that you experience them from time to time. Can you talk about that? Is it like a fleeting, just an insight that vanishes?
Well, there can be the great peace that really we can have, especially on a long retreat, can feel a lot of peace and ease, and the defilement's not coming up in any significant way. It can be a little bit more of an ongoing feeling. And, you know, it might be times when we're in nature on a retreat that we feel that greater sense of peace. It becomes a bigger draw. And then there's those times, moments of insight, like really clarity on everything is arising and passing. There is nothing. There is nothing solid there. And where am I? There's no me here. And it's like they kind of shake us to our core to begin to see more clearly the way they shake us to our core and allow a clear seeing of the way things are to arise very naturally. Insights arise from being present and aware. And
not being eaten by coyotes.
and the realization, I guess I'll say it, I mean, Nibbuddhi is like there's a quenching of desire, a quenching of the longing to attach to it the way we prefer things to be. And nirvana is simply the complete quenching of all attachments. All attachments. No, really understood is no greed, no aversion, no delusion. That's all. That's nirvana. I think that's all I'll say about it.
Thank you. I think that's a good place for us to stop for the moment. Does anybody have any announcements?
I'm your host today, and will you please stay and enjoy the company of the Sangha? There are some refreshments, some cookies and fruit, and hot water for tea. If you use a cup, please just put it into the sink and I'll wash it later. I'll be going around with a donut bowl to accept contributions to cover our expenses. Your generosity is appreciated. Donations in the range to $10 to $20 help the Sangha meet its expenses. These include the honorarium for our Dharma speakers, rent for this beautiful center, our quarterly newsletter mailed mostly to people in prison. There's a newcomer sign-up sheet on the credenza if you wish to be included and receive our Sangha membership directory. Please sign up and include contact information if you wish to share with the group. Some members go out to lunch after the meeting. Everyone is welcome to join. The group meets at the front door around 12:30.
Clint, do you have an announcement?
Me?
Yes.
Yes, I do. I have a sad announcement. I don't know whether it's been said before and I missed it, but our long-term member, Mike Borman, died about a week ago from pneumonia that was complicated by cancer. And he's been a part of this community for many, many years, and a special person in many ways. And a personal friend for me. And I miss him, and I think others in this group miss him also, and I just wanted to make that announcement so people know what's going on. And that's it.
Thank you. Are there any other announcements? Let's rise for the dedication of merit. By the power and truth of this practice, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all be free from sorrow
and the causes of sorrow. May all never be separated from the sacred happiness which is without sorrow, and may all live in equanimity without too much attachment or too much aversion, believing in the equality of all that lives.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.